This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with D-Day paratrooper Tom Rice of Coronado, California. He's 93 years old, but he's planning to jump out of a plane again next June, just like he has the last few years, to honor those who died on the longest day. When we left off, he was waiting to lead 17 other jumpers out the door of their C-47 and out over the dark French landscape. And you described some of the chaos, and I have to ask, were you nervous? Were you scared?
I had too many jobs to do.
You were too busy to even think about it.
I was too busy. Mm-hmm. With the parapacks, with a number of guys. For instance, we took showers just before we took off.
Right.
Just before we took showers, we had dinner. Just before dinner, the colonel got us all grouped together, the entire regiment, and he stood on the hood of the Jeep and made a speech. Now, he had a Bowie knife, and he had a 4 by 8 foot piece of plywood. On one side was a picture of Tojo, on the other side was a picture of Hitler. And he practiced at 50 feet throwing that darn Bowie knife. he had one time it bounced back and cut him.
Oh.
But anyway, here he is on top of the Jeep, and he's giving us a speech. The speech is recorded in a book that I wrote, word for word. He had his Bowie knife down on his ankle, and he reached down to get the Bowie knife, hold it over his head, and we're going to want every one of you to be able to put this knife in a German.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he reached down, and it wouldn't come out of his case. So he went to his French knife. So that incident became the laughing activity of the regimental unions after that. Colonel Johnson tried to get that Bowie knife out, and he couldn't do it. He made the best of it. So then he jumped down like a turkey vulture going to his first meal. He shook hands with every single one of us,
mm-hmm.
You know, wished us Godspeed and whatever else.
Did that fire you up a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it relaxed us more.
So getting back to your drop zone, you said out of 13,200 paratroopers, you got the worst drop zone.
We got the worst drop in the entire division, really.
Out of the whole D-Day operation?
On the whole D-Day operation, yeah.
Why? What happened? Where were you dropped?
When we took off at 10:41, English double summertime, we flew at 5,000 feet. We assembled in groups of 45 each. That was called a section.
Mm-hmm.
I was in section 14, third from the lead plane on the right. I'm jumping number one. We dropped down to 1,500 feet after the section had organized itself. Now, we were about 100 feet wingtip to wingtip,
mm-hmm.
Real close, tight formation. We flew past Jersey and Guernsey Island. In the water was a small submarine that emitted a signal to show that we were on the right track for the pilots to follow. And then we got to another signal beyond Jersey and Guernsey Island, and at that point we turned left. Now, if you can visualize the Cottonton Peninsula on the left and the Brittany Peninsula on the right. This was a neat scheme because the Germans didn't know whether we're going to go right or we're going to go left.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned left. I'm at the door getting things organized and following instructions. I looked out and I saw low tide. I saw the community of Brownsville, and I could see the pattern of rivers that ran into the channel there. White light is on. Red and green are off.
Mm-hmm.
When we hit Brownsville, the red light goes on, means we got 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was stand up and hook up. We're all standing up. We're holding on to the steel cable that runs, 3/8 inch steel cable that runs right through the center. Mm-hmm. We have to hook up our webbing to that, mm-hmm. with an anchor line snap fastener in our left hand and make sure it faces the right way. Got it faced the wrong way, could be in trouble. So stand up and hook up. It was verbal signals and mechanical signals so that everybody understood. A red light was on. We were checking. We ran into fog. Now, we're less than 100 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
The lead plane had a blue light on the dome, and it was at a little lower altitude. The others were staggered up a little bit so the pilots could see the blue light. When that blue light goes on, that means that they got that lead plane got the signal from the pathfinders, and they crossed the T, and They snapped on the green light. Everybody snaps their green lights on. So we jump at that point. Ran into fog. I was looking out the door, and I could see just almost a rectangular area that was just filled with tracers. There were yellow, there were red, there were green, and white. It looked like the 4th of July, you know. Nothing bursting like that, but tracers coming up.
You guys have been spotted, and the enemy's firing at you.
Yeah, well, we were heading into that.
Oh, this is ahead of you. You can tell that this
is what we're going to have to go through.
The artillery fire is already happening.
It's already happening. We're going to have to go through this. Mm-hmm. So they avoided it, and I think the pilot may have panicked a little here, because there was an investigation afterwards. We swung off to the right. All of Company C swung off to the right because we had 9 planes. Mm-hmm. Our company commander ended 20 miles from our drop zone. We didn't get together for a whole week. We were spread all over the place. We were originally, as I understood it, to jump on drop zone B. They found out that drop zone B was underwater. So it was fortunate that when they broke the pattern of flight, we were over the edge of D. And I went out over the edge of D. The only thing that bothered me is that I was going to get castrated because the machine gun bullets were on the left wing and they might come through the floor of the plane, you know. Mm.
So as you're jumping, your plane's getting hit.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You could hear it on the wing.
Wow.
And now our gas tanks are not self-sealing. And the pilot is yawing and pitching. We're going up and down to avoid penetration with shells, you know, mm-hmm. and bullets, whatnot. Up and down. The guys were wobbling. The green light goes on. I jump, and just as I did, number one and number two men pull the switches. The plane goes up because the load was dropped.
Right.
And I went out the door at the same time. And when I turned, the prop blast, we were going 165 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. We got a jump at 95 to 100. The jump master, lieutenant, called the pilot and said, slow the thing down, we can't jump. Now the pilot's yawing and pitching, whatnot. Mm-hmm. He ignored it. So when I went out, we were yawing and pitching, and the plane went up 50 feet. The parapets dropped. The prop blast hit me and threw me up against the side of the aircraft.
Wow.
My left arm got caught in the lower left-hand corner of the door. So I swung out. My helmet came down over my face. My reserve parachute was forced up to my face because the musette bag was underneath. So I didn't know what the dickens was going on. 2.8 seconds transpired. Nothing should have opened by that time. So I swung in and hit the aircraft side again, swung out, got the helmet up, and I saw the parapax cover of the parachute flapping under the rudder of the airplane. So number two and number three man got loose, got out. Mm-hmm. So when I swung back in, I turned a little bit and I got free.
I can't imagine what that feels like. You talk about disaster here. This is your moment, your first experience in the war, really, in what's going to be a combat situation. You almost didn't get away from the plane.
Get away from it, yeah.
And you would have died.
Yeah.
If you couldn't free yourself, probably.
I had a Hamilton wristwatch, a gold Hamilton wristwatch. It cost me $150, and that was stripped right off of my arm. My arm was black and blue from the armpit down to the wrist.
Ooh.
And I didn't know it until 3 weeks later and taking some clothes off. We didn't take any clothes off, you know. I have to guess at the altitude. I'll make a conservative guess. I jumped from 500 feet to 400 feet, 750.
Uh-huh.
So I was on the ground pronto.
That must have been a pretty rough landing.
Oh, yeah. It was a hard landing. So,
what'd you come down in? What kind of terrain?
It was grassy area that was more pasture than anything, and then a small ditch that was, about 6 feet deep, full of water, smelly, dirty water. And so here I am on my back. I can't get my harness off because the musette bag, the reserve parachute, a Mae West, and a quick release. Now, the quick release had a toadstool type thing on it, and when you arm it, a red dot shows, and then you hit it like that and it springs out.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know about that thing,
right?
Okay, whatever they want to call it. I couldn't get at that thing. I had a double zipper up here under my chin with a switchblade knife, so I unzipped that And incidentally, I had the cricket under there. You know about the cricket?
Tell everybody about the cricket.
Yeah, okay. So just mention that so you're on track with me.
The cricket's going to come in handy later.
Yeah, maybe.
In theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
In theory, yeah.
Yeah.
So the cricket and the jump knife are in the same pocket, right? Double zippered right under my chin.
Uh-huh.
So I unzipped that. The cricket fell out. I lost it and didn't know it. I got the double-bladed knife out and start cutting the risers. I got halfway through one riser, and number two and three man came up. They had the mortar. Evidently, they had found one of the bundles and got the mortar. So that means time has gone by here for a little bit. So we crossed the canal, and Frank Ficarota, one of the guys in the carrying the mortar parts, went into the canal. We had to dig him out. He came out smelling like you can't believe, yelling and screaming. This is supposed to be a quiet situation, you know.
So, yeah, it's dark. Yeah, it's the middle of the night. Dark. You're supposed to be surprising the enemy.
So we got him quiet, and we worked our way over to a decomposed granite road. I heard some footsteps maybe 150 yards away on decomposed granite. So I got him quiet, did the click. One of the guys did the click. Mine was lost. And they got a click back.
And that's what, when you mentioned the cricket earlier, some people are saying, what, he's carrying little bugs around? No, this was a device that would allow you to communicate with others without drawing too much attention.
That's right. And no identification, you see.
What does it sound like?
Click, click, mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. You just didn't hold one click. You went click, click.
Right.
And the answer would be double click, 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 click. Then we would work toward each other, clicking continually.
Right.
We got within safe distance. Then we'd use the password. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're in the airborne and you're one of my friends, and we clicked successfully. I'm not sure about you. It could be a German enemy that has one of these things.
Yeah.
So I go with the password, flash.
Gordon.
You would then recognize that flash. Uh-huh. Possibly I'm an American.
Right.
I don't know still about you. You come back with thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Then that puts me at ease that you possibly are an American. Now, to cinch it from flash, thunder, then I'd say welcome. And a German trying to pronounce welcome, the W is a V. Welcome, you see. You'd pick that up real quick. Mm-hmm. Then we'd meet, get up and hug each other and find out who we are. And he's probably somebody from the 82nd Airborne.
And you're doing all this, which you've never done before, not in this situation, in the dark, with an arm that almost got ripped off, a back that's probably all bruised up from
probably,
the impact.
Yeah.
Were you feeling pain? Were you even conscious of that?
No. I mean, our focus was to do what we're supposed to do and get organized and group.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got objectives.
And did you have any idea where you were?
No. Didn't even know I was on Drop Zone D. I made just the edge of Drop Zone D. Number 18 man, Marvin Van Buskirk, ended up in the English Channel.
Wow.
He was a pugilist and a strong swimmer, and the parachute opened up on him and started pulling him ashore a little bit, so he was aided in that to get ashore. And when he got ashore, he took all his clothes off and hid in a trench until he heard the shooting and got his wet clothes back on again and joined it.
Wow. So you were really close to the coast.
Yeah. It's about 6 miles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So we got these guys were coming down the road. It must have been 8 or 10 of them coming down the road, and we clicked them and met them, and we stood up and kind of conversed. And one of them came to me and said, "I've got a hand grenade with the pin pulled. You cannot put the pin back in a hand grenade. It's not possible because the bend is bent."
Right.
And he probably didn't have the pin anyway. So here he is with a hand grenade, squeezing it like almighty. And if you ever let loose of it, that spoon goes up. You know what the hand grenade is like.
Yeah.
And it fires the cap, and it goes down the train of powder, and then 5 seconds it goes. Oh, he said, "I got a hand grenade with a pin pulled." I said, "Okay, give it to me." Had everybody get down. I got down and rolled over to the ditch, dropped it in the ditch, rolled back, and by the time I got to the middle of the road, the thing exploded, and I'm covered with water. So we went on down the road a little further. No enemy. What is this, the game we're playing here?
Hold on a second. Why did you want the hand grenade? Why did you put yourself in greater danger?
Because I was responsible for those guys, and they looked like I didn't recognize. Here's what we one of the things we tried to learn is the profile if we saw these guys at night. and our maneuvers and their voice. I wasn't sure. There was a number of them, and I wasn't sure about their voices or their profiles, but I felt that things were friendly enough. I just took it on myself. I was a ranking guy there, even though I may not have been. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I found out who the guy was that had a hand grenade, and he was a lieutenant, and I'm just a staff sergeant.
But your leadership qualities rose to the occasion.
Yeah, right. I had to.
Yeah.
So.
Sorry for interrupting. I'm sure a lot of people are saying, wait, if that guy, that's his problem, that's not your problem.
So we broke up into groups and went on down the road. I'm saying to these guys, nothing's happening here, but I saw a house on the side of the road about 50 yards back and said, we got to investigate this. So I set about five of them around to the back of the house. And Floyd Martin and me and another guy went to the front of the house. I said to Floyd Martin, don't bang on the door like an ugly American. Just knock, you know. He banged on it with his rifle, but you could hear it from probably 2 kilometers away. And after about 30 seconds or so, a Frenchman came to the door. Blasé as could be. You wouldn't believe this. In a long, white nightgown from shoulder to floor. With a white tousled nightcap.
Wow.
With a dish with a candle in it lighted. Now, if you were in that situation, what would you think or say or do?
That's a good question. What'd you do?
I started to laugh.
I think I probably would have laughed.
I started to laugh like you can't believe. And the reason being, I suddenly recognized that's the Christmas Carol play, Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
I saw that. And it looked like...
It looked like Scrooge.
Yeah, right. So he didn't respond to anything, so I just pushed him aside and went in. Three or four of the guys followed that were behind me, and I unloaded the map and put it on the floor and tried to get him to tell us where we were. He finally saw the word Carentan, and he pointed in that direction. His wife came out from another door dressed the same way. That was no laugh. I didn't laugh at that one. After trying to talking with him and not frightening him, he said he'll want to be excused for a minute. So we did okay. So he went out and he got 6 rounds of ammunition. He gave us 4 and he kept 2. And so we left right away. Assured him we're not going to do anything because our objective was down the road. We only ended up 2 kilometers. And incidentally, a guy gave me a trophy. And on the trophy is a paratrooper. And on the side of the trophy is St. Marie Dumont. And that was our objective.
And I have a picture of that trophy up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That was quite a coincidence, St. Marie Dumont. But as for achieving that objective, as for the fighting that took place at Normandy, what Tom would experience in Operation Market Garden in Holland, and how he was wounded at the Battle of the Bulge, you may have figured out by now we're going to have to save that until next time. What a memory he has. What a story he has. And don't miss the most intense moments next time on Hometown Heroes, when the things that this World War II paratrooper witnessed and endured will remind you again that freedom is not free.